Talk given Sunday, 20th April, 1975. Our last group weekend at the end of March marks the climax of our considerations during these 13 years since the group started. You may recall we tried to express in words something of the nature and the condition of the state of communion. Communion, which is the state of samadhi. Samadhi, not only in its restricted sense of deliberately entering the jhanas and reaching the end point, which the Buddha called touching nirvana with the body, not only in that sense, but in the maintenance of that state of samadhi throughout the day. You may recall the Buddha declared openly to a questioner that he abides continuously in the shunyata phala samadhi, that state of communion which is the fruit of the realization of the voidness of all defilement. This is the voidness referred to in that particular discourse. That when a man is utterly purified, he is, as the Buddha would have said, an arahant, the perfected holy one. He himself uses those terms, the perfected holy one. When he is in that state, he is void of all ill. And the person who is void of all ill is continuously aware of existence in terms of total freedom from all grasping. This is a very important point to understand. Being thus, he is in complete relationship, therefore, with all objects, all persons, all situations throughout every moment of the day of his life, of every day. It is extremely difficult for ordinary mortals to imagine what this is like. This state of perpetual communion in which the perfected Holy One lives, the perpetual samadhi. And it was taught not only by the Buddha. You will find it through the Upanishads and in all Hindu teaching. You will find it in the Zarathustrian teaching. You will find it also in the New Testament, if one knows how to interpret certain statements of Jesus. And certainly, throughout the great teachings of the Kabbalah, there is that indication. Now, we tried to put in words some of the essential points marking this state of communion. At the last weekend. That is why I am saying now that that last group weekend in March marked the climax of our efforts to understand the meaning, the purpose, the significance of living the religious life. What happens to you or to me in fulfillment? When I have climbed out of the subhuman state and released the pure human. That is why, as far as I can see myself, that weekend is extremely significant, and what was said at that weekend. We must, therefore, if we have taken the trouble to look into it carefully, recalling what was put before us for our considerations, we must ask ourselves, how far have we, you and I, been able to realize in our own lives something at least of this? What are the simple points which should be perfectly clear to us? Let me put it in the form of one or two questions. You recall, time and again, I have said that perhaps the first rule of the religious life is never to take leave of good sense. And I've always taken the trouble to explain carefully what is meant by good sense in the religious context. It has little or no relationship with what the world calls common sense. The common sense of the world is indeed common in its pejorative, its derogatory meaning. It means inferior, not worthy. The common sense of the man of the world is the common sense of one who is sick in his soul, who is liable to delusion, who is in a state of conflict, who is conditioned, confused, fearful. By fearful I mean he is in a state of fear and anxiety constantly. He is the one who exercises common sense, as it is called. And you will find in every single instance, practically without a single exception, you will find that that common sense is self-concerned, self-oriented. It is the perpetuator of the separation between himself and the world in which he lives. In other words, it goes side by side with what in Christian terminology is called the sinful state, the state of division, of divorce from the source, from our source, which is also our goal. That is common sense. And good sense is something different. He whose mind and heart are pure, who has ceased to grasp, who uses his senses in order to understand the fact as the fact, he is the one who can exercise good sense. Because that sense, that sensibility is free of selfness. It is free of greed, of violence, of delusion, and so forth. And therefore, he has good sense. And that is the meaning of good sense in the religious context. Now we must ask ourselves the question, here we come to meetings, we join societies, we have a sincere drive from within, an aspiration towards what is worthy. How far do we live in terms of good sense? This is very important. Are we able to use good sense throughout the day, naturally and spontaneously? Or are we still so enslaved by the pleasure drive, by the desire for comfort, for what we in worldly terms call security and so forth? Are we still tied to our possessions, our skills, our attainments, our art treasures, our this, our that, and the other? Or have we good sense? The good sense to let our aesthetic nature express itself fully and enjoy in the pure non-grasping sense of the term. Enjoy all the beauty and the loveliness and the happiness that the whole cosmos continually keeps pouring into us. If we do that without grasping, then we exercise good sense in relationship to all these things that come into our life every day. It is impossible to avoid pure pleasure, pure happiness in that sense, through the senses. Because nature has so made the world, so made us, that all this in its purity, coming to us through our sense of sight and hearing and touch and taste and smell and so forth, is for our delight. You see how the Bible put it, the Garden of Eden was made for man's delight. Enjoy any and every fruit in it, but enjoy it not as a blind, grasping worldling, but as man, the living image of transcendence itself, which is quite different. So, do we exercise good sense in all our life? In our relationships at home, with our family, in our relationships with our friends, with those who are only business acquaintances or whatever it may be. in our relationship with any and every situation as it crops up, either in the immediate now around us, or as we hear about it through world news and so forth. Do we exercise good sense? This is an important point, because in our own day and age, the media, as they are called, disseminate all over the world what is happening. And when we hear or read the news, do we remain poised and calm, equally compassionate towards the oppressor and the oppressed, the killer and the killed? Or do we get into a turmoil of hate and anger, cloaking it under the term righteous indignation? You see, the meaning of the term good sense. If we never take leave of good sense, if we have developed that power in us, then every single moment of the day, out of our minds and hearts, there goes forth an influence which is a healing influence, which is a benediction for the whole world. Good sense. This is the starting point only, because this good sense is the thing that continually operates in our ordinary sense functioning and our ordinary brain processes in everyday life. At the most concrete level of our being, and if this good sense is operative in this way, at the most concrete level of our being, it opens all the gates out of our concrete psychophysical existence for the functioning of the sense of transcendence, the transcendence which is embodied in us. Can you escape then being a light unto yourself and to the world? Can you escape being a friend of the world? You remember the words of the Buddha? A friend is one who will even lay down his life for you. It's a long discourse where he talks about what a friend does for you. And he says this. And Jesus, of course, said, no man hath greater love than this, than he lays down his life for you. So such a person is a friend of humanity, of all humanity. One cannot be a friend to particularly chosen persons. Where there is preferential choice, there is very restricted, very limited friendship. Loving kindness, metta, compassion, karuna, and all these wonderful things that we talk of, they are all in a sorry state, so to say. Is it not supremely significant that whenever the Buddha talks of the Brahma Viharas. His teaching starts with that which is nearest. And what can be nearer to oneself than one's own self? All right. You suffuse your being with loving kindness, with compassion. You free your own being from enmity, malevolence, and so forth, from all grasping, from all desiring. This is very important. We suffer because we desire to hold the loved one or something. If we got free of that graspingness, that pain would disappear and love in its purity would be there. We start like that. We extend it to the teacher, to our dear ones, and with increasing proficiency to our acquaintances, to the hostile ones, and so on till we fill the entire world with this tremendous power which goes out from the steadfast heart and the pure mind, a power of love which is creative and which is healing to all the world without any exclusion. And that puts you directly in touch with what is called the infinity of Akasha and of Vijnana. Akasha, the root of all material existence and manifestation. Vijnana, used in the sense of these source of all consciousness, of all mind. You see what wonders love can do. Not as a poetic phrase, not as a little emotion, but as a tremendous fact throughout the universe. So you see, good sense opens the doors for that sense of transcendence, and it goes out and embraces the whole world. I cannot see what results spring from that. The so-called hard-headed practical man of the world would say, "Oh, this is all airy-fairy nonsense. Look at the state of the world. What has your existence, you perfected Holy One, what difference has your existence and your entering into transcendental states done to prevent the evil?" But have any of the hard-headed practical ones for the last 3 or 4 million years since man has been on the globe succeeded in preventing these evils? Or have not these very same hard-headed practical ones, with their ideas, their fixations, their passions, ambitions, and all the rest of it, been the prime sources for producing the misery and the sorrow of the world? So it's no good turning around and saying the holy ones are useless. We don't know. And the more research takes place, the more is it discovered how subtly and wonderfully the powers of the mind act. There are mysterious functionings throughout our life and throughout the life of the world. of which we are very ignorant, quite ignorant. You may remember that passage I quoted from Lyle Watson's Supernature. To show how the plant world, the animal world are so sensitive to suffering, and how the cosmos is really united, is held as a whole living organism by the power of love, by the power of sympathy, the sensitivity which responds to another's pain in the plant and the animal worlds. And we so-called humans alone are capable of being inhuman and bestial. And we are not sufficiently sensitive to it. So, with good sense, starting with good sense, see what a lot emerges. How far then have we realized good sense in our daily life? Let us notice another point, very closely allied to this. Have we realized a state of quiet and silence? Let us not look at it in a little way, in a small way, by confining the meaning of quietness and silence to no talking at all. If you forcibly repress all talk, you'll find that you are no forerunner yourself, nor have you helped anybody else. But at the same time, consider how we talk, whether we speak aloud or whether, as we say, we are thinking, which is just inaudible talking with the brain. The brain is constantly chattering. This matter of speech is extremely important. Are we quiet? Are we silent? All the religious disciplines, just like the discipline of yoga, and yoga is a word which is a very general word which includes every aspect of religious discipline. All of them point to the imperative necessity for the quietness and the silence. Consider what happens if we are quiet and silent. We have ceased to be obtrusive upon the world. Not only upon the world, which is what we commonly call outside ourselves, but our own inner world. What is our own true inner world? It is the world where our humanness and our human awareness and consciousness functions freely, not our subhuman awareness. This is the point. This inner world, this spiritual world, this spiritual state of our own being from moment to moment is obtruded upon by this noise that we make all the time. Quiet and silent. Man is then truly man. What is all our noise and chatter about? sensational excitement about obtaining this, that, and the other. Anxiety, fear, pain, distress because one does not obtain what one desires or has brought about the presence of that which is disagreeable, and so forth. Are not these the things that we chatter about in our own minds all the time? And it's all self-related. It's just oneself all the time. The self which is cut off from the totality. And that is why so much ill comes into being for oneself as well as for those around one. Are we quiet and silent in any measure? We say, now I will spend half an hour or 5 minutes or 5 hours meditating. Right? We go through the motions. We sit down, we cross our legs or whatever it is, we count our breaths and so forth. Are we quiet and silent? Outwardly, we appear to be in a seraphic state, you know, with a lovely, charming smirk upon our faces, with our eyes closed. But are we truly quiet and silent? Are we not doing this utterly self-concerned that I shall enter the state of meditation, of communion, etc., etc.? Has that miserable little Mephistopheles ceased to cackle with delight that selfness is triumphing here on the highest possible plane which I am capable of reaching? Watch it, watch it. Go deeply into it. You see, if you do go deeply into it, and you suddenly become all-seeing. You see not only in front of you with your eyes, but your whole head, let us say, is a big eye which sees everything. You will catch Mephistopheles at once. And then that's isolative self-consciousness will vanish. And in the vanishing of that, you will find that you are at peace. You yourself are at peace and quiet. Because all the egoism is cleared out of the reality of the ego. The person, the psychophysical living being is there. The same psychophysical living being. It is there. But all egoism, I-ness, drawing things to oneself for my growth, my happiness, and everything is out. The conscious mind will play terrible tricks. It will say, oh, no, no, this is not true. I am doing it unselfishly. The very effort to be unselfish as a specific objective, which can be isolated and held up for display as unselfishness, is the very proof, the perfect proof, that one is not unselfed. Do you get this? Because this is so subtle. It's taken a foolish fellow like me 65 to 68 years before I began to see into this, really to see it. So now I can reasonably easily catch Mephistopheles by the tail and twist him round. Recall some of the discourses of the Buddha, which are couched in the form of a dialogue between himself and Mara, the evil one, the destroyer. And the Buddha says very quietly, "I know you, Mara. You're not going to catch me out. I know you." And then all that happens is that Mara gets a bit dejected. He's lost the game. But you see the significance. Mara is never slain, never destroyed. He cannot be. As long as there is specific, particular, finite existence or expression of anything, Mara is necessarily one of the duals involved. Necessarily so. But to understand him, as the Buddha used to say, "I know you, Mara." Or to use Jesus' phrase in another context and not quite applicable here, but still similar to it, "Get thee behind me, Satan." The Buddha talking like this to Mara means that he has understood and passed beyond the conflict which would otherwise be engendered. So you cannot deliberately practice unselfishness, because the unself state is the infinite. The immeasurable. You can't grasp it. You can't hold it. It holds you and everything else. Its totality. But when your awareness opens up into that totality, transcendence has come into play. And then there is no isolative self-consciousness at work. And then you are quiet. That is the meaning of being quiet, the meaning of being silent. You see? Doesn't mean that you stop talking. It doesn't mean that you can blank your mind in the sense of making it a vacuity, an absolute vacuum. Just doesn't happen. No such thing. When you are quiet in that sense, not obtruding upon the world, not obtruding upon the world which is your own self, the world within, then all that noise ceases. But the manifestations in their purity of your very existence here go on in perfection. And when they go on in perfection, you may, if you like, compare it to pure music, to a song, not to a cacophony. You see? And that is the silence. The meaning of the silence. This is little understood. This doctrine of the void has been so hopelessly misunderstood. When anybody starts talking about the void and giving what sound like very learned explanations and so forth, just let the mind be perfectly quiet and sensitive and feel out whether the speaker is free, is void of greed, hate, fear, delusion, and so on. If you really get the impress this man is free of it, then listen to his words about the void. Otherwise, out of the kindness of your heart, say, well, another little cackle going on, and that's all there is to it. Beware. So, the quiet and the silence. These are just two of the very important things we must ask ourselves. Have we realized good sense? Have we realized the state of quiet and silence in our own lives? Use this meditatively throughout the day. Other points there are also, but we'll touch upon them on another occasion. Through the years, we have tried to see a vision of man's fruition and fulfillment. So we have tried to go into all the different scriptures of the world, but particularly Buddhism, because that's how we started these groups. That was the reason. We have looked into other great religions too, and they are deep teachings. We have tried to understand them. We have tried to see the vision so that we can set our sights on the real, on the true, on transcendence itself. Not putting it up there, away from us, far away, but trying to realize it here and now. So that our efforts are saved from being misdirected. If our sights are not correctly set, we shall everlastingly be self-centered. And self-centeredness is the root power which keeps us separate from everything and everybody and perpetuates evil. So we have tried to see something of this vision. And at that meeting at the end of March, last March, we tried to see what is implied in being in this state of communion, how you actually function with the senses. You remember what I said? When you are the perfected Holy One, always in that state of communion, through your eyes, transcendence sees every object and at the same time sees all materiality embodied in that object. In other words, you are simultaneously aware of the particular and the finite, which is the changing, the passing, the becoming process, and you also see at the same time the eternal, the unchanging, the immutable, the totality, the perfect thing. And when you see like that, hear like that, touch and taste like that, feel and think like that, what happens? You are incapable of any ill. You have no problem of acceptance or rejection. When transcendence the infinite through the finite eyes, sees the finite world and sees itself embodied in it all. What is there to accept? What is there to reject? What is there to grasp? You see, the peace, the beauty, the fulfillment that is implied there. Then each one of you is the living vehicle of transcendence through which something quite beyond what the brain of man can know comes to fruition. And you have fully served the purpose of your existence and fulfilled your divine destiny.